Hello and welcome to the latest edition of ICTJ podcast series, in which we have quite a special guest. Today we are honored to welcome Patty Bloom, Senior Legal Advisor for the Center for Justice and Accountability. Welcome, Patty.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today we'll analyze what is quite a historic date in the recent history of the struggle against impunity here in the United States, but also internationally, and that is the 8th of April. It is related to two former government officials of El Salvadorian government who were in power during the Civil War, General Carlos Eugenio Vides Casanova was what is called removed, and Patty will explain this term. Due to his role in human rights abuses during the time that he was serving as the defense minister in the government of El Salvador, while Colonel Innocente Orlando Montana decision was made to start the extradition proceedings in relation to a case that has opened in Spain against him for his role in a very specific one of the most emblematic massacres from the civil war in El Salvador, and that is the murder of six Jesuit priests there. Home care person and her daughter. Patty, both of these cases have, both of these developments have come as a result of cases that were undertaken by the Center for Justice and Accountability, one of them in 1999, more than 15 years ago, against General Vides Casanova, and one of them since 2008 against Colonel Montana. Tell me, first of all, if you can walk our listeners through the process and tell us why has it taken so long and what was the feeling at the end of this when victory finally arrived?
Can I start with the feeling at the end of it? Which, of course, is elation, that these cases, this work, which I'm sure other people who have been speaking to you have said, is such a long-term commitment. You cannot go into it with an expectation that you're going to get immediate results, and you really have to be committed for the long haul to whatever paths, you know, show themselves in the course of trying to work on accountability and anti-impunity issues. The case against General Vides Casanova, as you mentioned, was initially filed in 1999. It was one of the first cases on the docket of the Center for Justice and Accountability when it was created in 1998. And we immediately began an investigation to try to look at whether there might be the possibility of using this unique U.S. statutes, which are civil litigation, to sue Vides Casanova and one of his compatriots, Jose Guillermo Garcia, who had been his predecessor as Minister of Defense in El Salvador, for crimes that they had committed in El Salvador. And that investigation took us to be in contact with several victims who had survived horrendous torture in El Salvador. And those three people ended up as the plaintiffs in this litigation, which is called Ramagosa versus Garcia and Vides Casanova. And the trial against Vides Casanova and Garcia as defendants occurred in West Palm Beach, Florida in 2002, and there was a decisive jury verdict against both of them for responsibility for the torture of our clients, and the jury awarded collectively an over $54 million judgment against the two of them.
Again, this is in a way very particular to the United States, that a civil case is brought against someone for such serious charges of gross human rights violations. How was it possible at all for these people to become residents here, lead normal lives, when such charges were in the public domain for quite a long time?
It's not really known exactly how they smoothed his path to come here. He did come here as a lawful permanent resident and was, I'm sure, intending to be anonymously living in the United States and did not want a spotlight shined on him. Once it was discovered that he was in the U.S., that's when we began our investigation and other human rights organizations began to look into him and to Garcia for their participation and command over troops that carried out other human rights abuses. So, you know, just to get back to how it's even possible, it feels very random that in the United States you would have this trial that occurs in Florida against these two defendants who are living in Florida and these victims, some of whom are in the U.S., some of whom are outside the U.S. You know, all of it seems sort of fantastical. You know, how does that even happen? And it's kind of one of the hidden beauties of a moment in American history, which occurred in 1789 when the United States was first formed. As a nation. And the founding fathers of the United States were very aware of their role in an international community, that becoming a country, becoming the United States of America, really meant taking their place within the world community of nations. And consequently, they passed this little known, crazy little bit of law within the Judiciary Act of 1789, which was the first piece of legislation ever passed by the first Congress, saying that an alien, that is a non-citizen of the United States, could have access to the federal district courts for a tort, meaning a civil wrong, that was committed in violation of the law of nations. And it's just a simple little sentence that seems like, what is it really conveying? But it's conveying the meaning of being part of the world community, being part of a law of nations. And that law was used back then for various reasons, but was really updated and modernized by some very creative lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who saw it as an opportunity to start dealing with the modern human rights abusers, the modern violators of the law of nations, people who were responsible for torture, extrajudicial killing, arbitrary detention, etc. And that's the law that we were using. There was another aspect of the law that was updated by the Congress to sort of, again, to modernize the 1789 law, which is called the Torture Victim Protection Act, which created another basis for the use of a federal court as a possible, you know, location to try people for their involvement in human rights abuses. And a lot of people refer to it as the sort of U.S.'s civil universal jurisdiction, because the U.S. doesn't have a criminal universal jurisdiction statute. In a way, it really becomes the forum, you know, and it's so important to us and to think about these trials not just simply as, you know, X suing Y and hoping to, you know, have that person found liable, but it's also an opportunity to get out the full historic truth of what happened in that country. And I really think in the case of El Salvador, it really was one of the most, you know, important aspects of it, was that we were telling the truth of what happened during the conflict and the role that these top commanders played, and that information and awareness was being transmitted to people around the world and to people in El Salvador whose own history had been very much suppressed after the conflict ended.
We will come back to the impact of these decisions on El Salvador and that specific context. But I want to ask you, what do you think is the broader significance of these decisions here in the United States? Are we seeing a shift? You were talking about the policies that brought these people in. Are we seeing a shift in in policies when it comes to wanting now to weed these people out?
Well, certainly in the United States, the driving force of U.S. foreign policy is no more the Cold War. I mean, the Cold War doesn't really exist exactly. But what I think is really revealing is the fact that there are now entities within the U.S. government whose portfolio is to focus on human rights abusers in the U.S. And those people are absolutely committed to that focus, no matter who the people were and what their role was in U.S. foreign policy or U.S. military policy in the past. So that is really like a non-issue, basically, for them. So to go after Vidas Casanova for his role in human rights abuses in El Salvador is not really any different for them than going after people who were involved in the Bosnian conflict or people who were involved in the Rwandan conflict. And so to that extent, their focus and their, what they actually do on a day-to-day basis is kind of politically neutral. And that is certainly a dramatic shift. I mean, when we finished our case in 2002 and prevailed against Vidas Casanova and Garcia, within months we approached the then Immigration Naturalization Service, which was folded into the Department of Homeland Security. But this is even before the Department of Homeland Security existed, and really tried to press with, hey, we just did this whole trial against these guys. We put in all this evidence. You now should remove them from the U.S. It's really offensive that they're kind of getting to live here and live in their nice gated communities in Florida when they've just been found responsible by a jury of their peers of, heinous crimes, essentially. And that was in 2002. And it took until 2009 and a change in administration. I would really chalk it up to that for the most part, and the sort of resourcing of the units within the Department of Homeland Security that were going to be charged with the work on these domestic cases of human rights abusers in the U.S. To jumpstart the whole situation. So it really wasn't until 2009 that they began the proceedings to remove Vidas Casanova and Garcia from the U.S.
We could talk about this the manifestation of this new spirit, if you will, also through the actions of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement in relation to, you mentioned, Bosnia. There were hundreds of people who are now on the list of deportation for not disclosing their role in for instance, Srebrenica genocide and others. But let's keep our focus on El Salvador and these two decisions. The comment to the decision in relation to Colonel Montana, you said that this decision, and I quote, is an extraordinary step towards justice and individual criminal accountability. Would you please expand on that? Why do you think this decision is so significant?
Again, it really represents, I think, a shift in thinking among people who are in these really key positions within the U.S. government. They're working for, divisions within the State Department or the Justice Department or Department of Homeland Security that whose focus is to look at the U.S. as a place that should no longer be a safe haven for war criminals. One of the little things I just want to mention, though, to backtrack for a minute to Vidas, is that one of the really significant differences between the Vidas Casanova case and some of these other cases that Department of Homeland Security has pursued, including the ones that you mentioned regarding the conflict in Bosnia, is that they often use a person's failure to be honest on their applications for some sort of benefit as a basis for going after them. In Vidas's case, they went directly to the crimes. So they used this part of the statute that talks about a person who ordered, incited, assisted, or otherwise participated in torture or extrajudicial killing. So it wasn't really about, oh, did he lie on his application for permanent residence? No, it's really going to the heart of it. And that's one of the things that I think is so important about it. This guy was not just removed from the U.S., but he was removed from the U.S. for the human rights abuses over which he presided for, you know, close to a decade.
Let me remind us that at the heart of these cases, and for as long as they have taken, were survivors, victims of the abuses that were committed by those like General Vidas Casanova and Ignacio Montaner. What do you think these decisions mean for the victims in El Salvador who were not able to participate in the cases, who are still waiting for some sort of justice, especially in view of the amnesty that is still in force in the country?
My sense is it's extremely significant. All of the clients that we represented in litigation regarding El Salvador always felt that they were standing in for others. You know, they never felt like it's just my voice and it's just me being here and, you know, something happening to me. It was all about my survival has to mean something, and my survival means that I lived when other people died and I have to speak for them. And one of the things that I found so significant was the images from Vidas Casanova's forcible return to his country, in which he was greeted by a demonstration, a very, you know, dignified demonstration of people who are survivors and whose family members were victims of Vidas Casanova and the other generals and colonels. And there were, you know, people out there with photos of their children, you know, lists of names of the disappeared. Two of our clients in the lawsuit against Vidas Casanova now live in El Salvador. They were both there, you know, sort of on the front lines and very much a part of the community of civil society organizations that have really struggled to keep in the public eye, both at home and abroad, the question of, you know, where is the accountability for what happened in our country, what's happened to the disappeared, you know, so many of the same kinds of questions that we see in many other situations that have gone through some sort of transition. And I think what's extremely important at this historic moment in El Salvador's history, because El Salvador really, as a country that had a very broad blanket amnesty that was passed within 5 days of the release of the UN Truth Commission report on El Salvador, which was one of the early Truth Commission reports that named names specifically in the 32 cases that it investigated in detail, talked about specific individuals who should be held responsible for their role in those different crimes. You know, everything was kind of shut down very, very quickly. And that shutting down was not just the impossibility of criminal prosecution, but it was also kind of a silencing of the whole question of what the conflict had been about and what had happened during it. And it's been a slow but steady opening in El Salvador, from the creation of a peace wall with the names of all the victims to the apologies by the FMLN government for the massacre at El Mazote, for the killing of Archbishop Romero, for the Jesuit massacre, the fact that Archbishop Romero is about to be beatified and, you know, become a saint in the Catholic Church is enormous just in terms of the visibility of who that man was and who the Jesuits were as well, as really very strong and powerful voices for peace and equality in El Salvador. So many of these little openings have happened, but the big sort of thing that everyone's waiting for is that there is a case pending before the Salvadoran Supreme Court right now on the legitimacy of the amnesty law. It has already been declared illegal by the Inter-American Commission and the Inter-American Court in a series of cases about El Salvador that have been going on for, you know, 15 years. And it's really now going to be a question of whether the Salvadoran Supreme Court sees its responsibility to comply with Inter-American human rights standards. So that's, I think, something everybody's waiting for. And personally, I feel it's quite important.
We can see that the struggle against impunity in these countries has its ebbs and flows. If we look to Guatemala, we can see that it can go from total despair to great hope, back to
despair.
Some sort of,
yeah, exactly.
Yes, in your opinion, how do you see things unfolding now in El Salvador in the near future? In concrete terms, in the sense, if the Supreme Court's decision maintains the amnesty, what are the openings? What are the avenues for work to have this impunity and silence ended?
Well, I think you'll see sort of more emphasis on a couple of the other major pillars of transitional justice. So if the Supreme Court maintains the amnesty, you probably will see more pressure around a reparations program. It's something that the Inter-American Court insisted that Salvador should consider. The FMLN government has said that it would like to create a victims' reparation program. So I think you'll see, just as in other countries that where the pillar of criminal justice in transitional justice is kind of shut down or very, very limited resource-wise or for whatever other complex political reasons, that there will be maybe a resurgence in activism around some of these other alternatives. I think that Salvador is on a path, a path that started opening up really when the FMLN was first elected. And even though the FMLN has not been strongly committed, shall we say, to accountability and anti-impunity, they have tried to make inroads in their own way. Honestly, you know, I've been involved with CJA since its inception, and one of the reasons why we as an organization have committed so many resources to El Salvador was because there was not a possibility for criminal accountability in the home country. And also, honestly, because I think we all felt that as lawyers in the United States, that we really had a special obligation to this country. I mean, it was a country that was receiving the third highest amount of U.S. military aid for over a decade, which was about $2 billion a year, which in those days was a lot of money. And, you know, you're talking about a country that's the size of the state of Massachusetts. And the fact that about a fifth of the population was displaced and many people had come to the United States. So there's always been a tug, I think, for all of us in this feeling that El Salvador was sort of neglected, within the transitional justice paradigm because things have been shut down so quickly after this very important Truth Commission. But I think that there's a path now.
That was going to be my next question. Can you tell us or chart the progress that you see happening in the case of Colonel Montana, and also whether that is some sort of a blueprint for future cases?
Basically, what happened was that the Center for Justice and Accountability, as a popular prosecutor in collaboration with the leading human rights NGO in Spain, the Association for the Protection of Human Rights in Spain, filed a request to open an investigation into the Jesuit massacre. And Spain was an obvious venue for two major reasons, primarily because five of the victims were Spanish nationals and came, you know, from you know, families and still had relatives and you know, fellow priests that they knew when they were being trained, etc. And also because Spain, you know, had really sort of opened up through the Pinochet litigation to be, you know, a venue that lots of different organizations that people were looking at as a place to try to get some sort of criminal accountability. And we were successful in getting an investigation opened beginning in 2008 when we filed the case. And that investigation under the investigating judge, Eloy Velasco, lasted about 2.5 years. And we helped present, you know, private hearings, actually. None of it is public, where we presented various kinds of witnesses and thousands of pages of documents. And all of that resulted in an indictment against 20 people for their direct participation or command participation or conspiratorial participation in the crime. And one of the important things about that number is that it really represented, again, an attempt to really make an accurate historic record of the crime and be inclusive of all the different players that participated in a massacre that was not just a thing that happened, but was really a very planned out military, you know, campaign and collaborative effort of a number of different forces in the Salvadoran military to make this actual, you know, massacre on the campus of the University of Central America possible. And so we wanted to tell that story, and we were able to tell it to the judge that led to an indictment of 20 people, one of whom is now dead, so there's 19 currently alive defendants. In the course of that process, we discovered that Colonel Montana was in the United States. We had no idea that one of the defendants was actually, especially one of the three most powerful military men at the time of the assassinations, was living in the United States. And as a consequence, we, you know, we're able to work with the U.S. government and in their initial attempts to hold him criminally responsible for this immigration fraud and perjury in his obtaining of immigration benefits in the United States. He was sentenced to 21 months in prison. That became kind of the time frame, you know, in which we had to operate, because we knew that he would be released on April 15th, just last week. That was his release date. And so were an extradition proceeding to occur, it had to occur within that time frame. So the Spanish case was, you know, the inception was earlier, the investigation was earlier, and it kind of coincided then in the possibility of extraditing one of the defendants. The other defendants, there have been, obviously, their extraditions have been sought from El Salvador, but because of the amnesty law and some other technical things, which are not relevant, really, but primarily because of the amnesty law, they're not being sent to Spain to stand trial. So if the amnesty law were to be rescinded, or at least to be cut back in a way that would make it, you know, inapplicable to the Jesuit massacre case, it's also possible that other defendants would be made available to the Spanish court.
I will end this conversation with impressions from some friends that we have in El Salvador, like Carlos Dada, who is a founder of El Faro, and people from El Faro who see these decisions as possible catalysts of processes that have been paralyzed with the amnesty law and the political dynamics in El Salvador. And one thing that is fascinating for people who don't know Center for Justice and Accountability is the fact that this is a result of what we could call legal activism. That is a form that does not really exist everywhere in the same form. So if you could tell us what is the philosophy of the center, what other cases are you working on, and where do you think you will be going from here?
I would say that, you know, my view, the philosophy of the center is kind of a holistic approach to accountability and to be open to all different ways in which accountability might be sought and not to be concerned with just like one paradigm. You know, it's not just criminal accountability. It's this possibility of using civil cases. It's the possibility of working and collaborating with governments on removals and extradition and denaturalization and, you know, to look at the, you know, working very collaboratively with organizations in the home country about what kinds of things they want to press for. So it's very much, you know, looking at it as a whole. And one of the things that I did want to say is that I think that the most catalyzing event really will be if there's a trial in Spain. The whole idea that people should be tried for a crime which occurred in El Salvador against six priests on their campus and their housekeeper and, you know, her daughter. Fundamentally, I believe, and I think everybody at CJA believes, that of course that trial should happen in El Salvador, and that's what we would all wish. So the fact that it will occur in Spain, I think, is going to be another very catalyzing and galvanizing event that's going to reverberate very strongly back to El Salvador. And that it will really be raising for a lot of people who haven't thought about it, maybe for the younger generation who, you know, were born after the conflict. Well, why is this happening? And why is this trial happening in Spain? And I think that of everything, honestly, that we have done in all these years and, you know, the commitment that I personally have been involved with for over 17 years, this will probably be the most public, you know, display of, okay, this is this criminal trial, it's about this crime, you know, and how that will, as, you know, my colleague Naomi Rode Arriaza talked about the Pinochet effect, I think this will be the, you know, Jesuit massacre effect, essentially, that, you know, will reverberate and boomerang back to the home country.
Well, on that note, with a promise to keep following closely the development of this case and to have you back in the near future to discuss it further, Patty Bloom, I thank you very much for being our guest.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.